I had thought to discuss that the ideals of renunciation. What then are the marks of those whom I'd consider worthy of being accepted as true renunciates? They would be those who have achieved noteworthy progress toward the attainment of the following goals or virtues. They have no or very few attachments or desires. Well, that's fairly obvious. But you know, one thing that I have always suggested to people is that they build a bonfire mentally at night and then throw into that bonfire every desire, every attachment, so that you go to sleep feeling free. And every day, because the nature of the ego is to keep attracting things, even as you attract birds when you walk in the country, little thorns and so on. So the nature of the ego is to keep picking up new attachments and new desires and so on. So every day, throw these things into the fire. They have nothing to do with me. But this is the negative side of a renunciation. I want to be not rejecting, but accepting. Rejecting is neti, neti, not this, not that. It's an endless process, really. Whereas if you can get rid of that ego, which would like to acquire those attachments, there's nothing to be attached to. So the main thing we have to work on is the ego. But as I said at that renunciate talk the other evening, the consciousness of the ego not even existing was a very difficult concept to understand during Kali Yuga. People couldn't understand that I'm no different from you. It's like the flames on a stove, which if you put different colored chemical powders on them, they all look different. So all of us look different, are different in consciousness, because of all the accretion of many, many lifetimes of different attitudes, different... You look at what God has done, what man has done, with two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. It's amazing. Everybody's different. And so what we need to do is understand that this ego is really not our reality. You couldn't talk so easily about that in the old days. So the emphasis on neti neti was the stronger one, getting rid of attachments. There's a story which I enjoy telling, and you may have heard me tell it. Yeah, turn off your cell phones. One time here in a lecture... You see me blushing. I'm not blushing. But in this lecture, and many of you were there, a cell phone went off, and I said, we asked you please to turn off your cell phone.
It was your phone.
Funny, it was my phone. Well, anyway, the story that I want to tell, you've probably heard, but it's good fun. In American boot camp, training people to become soldiers during World War II, there was a soldier there, a young man, who went around looking at pieces of paper, looking at it, this isn't it, this isn't it, this isn't it. And he kept doing that all the time. Finally, they said, well, this man had better see the camp psychiatrist. So he went into the camp psychiatrist's office, and he picked papers off the desk there. No, this isn't it, this isn't it. Finally, the psychiatrist decided, well, this man really isn't fit for the Army, so he recommended him for a medical discharge. And as soon as he got this, he said, this is it! So, but that process took a lot of people, a lot of people, papers picked up. And what we need to do is get rid of this thing by just not having any ego to have the desires. And the more you don't feel the ego, the more there's nothing to worry about. You don't have that desire. So this is the positive side of renunciation. And we are more samadhi-oriented than rejection-oriented. So this is the Naya Swami. This is why I have this blue. Because blue is expansive. It's the color of the sky. And the color of calmness and of devotion. So it's a positive renunciation. Okay, now. They are without anger. Anger appears in the heart when one's desires are thwarted. This is a very important test of how spiritually developed you are. People who can get angry shows that they're full of ego and full of desires. We have to test ourselves by that litmus paper, you might say. If you can get angry, there's something wrong with you. Don't worry about what you're getting angry about. Other people may be wrong, but you shouldn't get angry about it. You can know that it's not that you lose discrimination. You can know this is not right, but it's not your business. And you can help them, but don't get angry about it. And that's how do you get that? You have to watch the feelings in the heart. The heart is the testing place. And one thing about Kriya Yoga, which is a wonderful thing, the wonderful thing, that your reaction, positive and negative, when you see a beautiful sunset, let's say, if you love it, you say, wonderful. A turtle can see a sunset and wonder if it's good to eat. But you can see it and you respond with joy. But your response is the thing that makes it beautiful, not the sunset. It doesn't mean anything to a turtle. Mm-hmm. So it's your response, your reaction that makes it beautiful. And when things are bad and you are unhappy, your reaction says, I don't like this. Mm-hmm. If you could become completely neutral, you'd accept everything just as this is the way it is. This is what a true sadhu must be. And so this is aligned to the movement of energy in the spine. If you can withdraw from thinking of the sunset and the good food and the nice person and that, all these things, and just always feel that you're reacting in your own self, it's not only the heart, it's the feelings in the heart that send the energy up and down. And in the astral spine, your breathing in the astral spine is in the Irda and the Pingala. So that when that energy comes in, it causes the inhalation. When the energy goes down, it causes the exhalation. And when you can get control over this current in the spine and get it balanced, then automatically you cease to react to this world. So there's a mechanical aspect to all this. If in your practice of Kriya, you become so centered here that you have control over the current in Ira and Pingala, then when you're completely even-minded, this is the goal of a yogi, to be even-minded and cheerful at all times. Then the energy becomes centered in the Sushumna, and then the energy goes up from the Sushumna. There's another very interesting thing. You know, the Mahabharata is a scripture. It's not just a rousing epic. When I was in college, I was asked to write an essay on what my criteria of great literature was. And I said, well, I've noticed that when I have something really great, that there's a white light around it. And when it's less great, then I sort of seem to see a more golden and blue, and then finally, even people like Chaucer, it's more like a brown color. And most books don't have any color to them at all. They're just dead. And, of course, I got a flunking grade. But I felt that I was right. And when I read the Iliad and the Odyssey, I saw a white light around those books. And I had no rational reason for saying they're great books. They seem like just rousing war stories. But I know that people in ancient times used to speak of divine Homer. And I think they were great epics that have... I haven't taken the trouble to try to analyze what all those different characters mean, but the Mahabharata is like that too. And also the Ramayana. But the Mahabharata, the whole thing, the population is inside you, it's not the outward. He used history as a network, a framework, around which to create an inner allegory. For example, Arjuna won Draupadi. in an archery contest. And he brought her home and he said to his mother, I brought a prize. And his mother said, well, you must share your prize with all your brothers. And so he had to let Draupadi marry all his brothers. Well, androgyny is something accepted in Tibet, but it's not accepted in India. How could this one single case of a woman marrying five brothers be acceptable? It's not. But what it really means is that Draupadi stands for the Kundalini. And the Kundalini has to, the Pandava brothers are five, and they stand for the five chakras. And Kundalini has to unite with the five chakras before it can reach the Sahasrara. So all of the Mahabharata is a very deep, deep allegory. And when you understand these scriptures that way, you find that all the old, you know, Indu is an old friend of mine, the oldest I have in India. And he told me that tantric yogi that I knew also, Narayan Swami, he was extraordinarily learned. He had a library of about 150 or 300,000 books, and he could tell you any line, any page. He said, just read this, open this book, look to page 35, line so and so, and he just had it all in his mind. But anyway, where was I?
Tantric.
Yeah.
The tantric guy who had this library.
Yes. And what did he say?
Indu.
What?
Indu told you something.
Indu told me about where am I? You see, it doesn't hurt to have notes. I never have notes, and I'm tired, and so my. Yeah.
The story of Draupadi Swamiji, which had to be shared with the other, with all the brothers.
Yes.
But it's not.
But where was I before I got into this mud?
Books of light around them. The books have light around them. That's
yes. We have the Mahabharata has light around it.
Yeah.
All these great scriptures. It's a wonderful story. But it has great power in it. You know, when you read the Ramayana, you don't know why it's great, but when you've finished reading it, even in English, you feel clean. Mm-hmm. There is a... You know, when Milarepa, who was a great yogi of Tibet many centuries ago, and he had committed a great sin originally. His mother, out of revenge for some relatives who had hurt her, he had studied black magic to destroy them. Mm-hmm. After destroying them, he suddenly realized what a sin he had committed and that he would suffer for many incarnations. And he wanted to get out from under this. Mm-hmm. And so he came to a guru, Guru Marpa. Mm-hmm. And the guru said he would take him, but he saw his books on the shelf there. Mm-hmm. He said, get rid of them. They were books on black magic and they emitted a bad vibration. Mm-hmm. So even the books that you pick up, they emit vibrations. This whole world is full of vibrations. And we must understand that some places have good vibrations, others don't. Mm. India has a wonderful vibration. You can feel it when you land on Indian soil, especially up here in the north. Mm. And the blessing that you get from that, if you tune into it, is very great. Rishis for thousands of years lived here. Well, anyway, to get rid of attachments, to get rid of anger, to get rid of all these things, we have to have that equanimity. And Kriya, which I was talking about, helps you to get centered. And then that Kundalini, which was Draupadi, uniting with the five chakras and raise the energy here. But Kriya brings you into that path. You can say that, well, all paths are equal, and they are in a sense, because they equally teach you to go toward God. And the differences the differences in religion are mostly superficial. You have the equator, and that's the ideal. Get to your center. And the people in the north are told to go south. The people in the south are told to go north. And it looks like they're contradicting each other, but they're only trying to go to the center. And so masters, when they come into this world, try to correct the needs of those times. And so some will give this emphasis, some will give that emphasis. But the purpose, the purpose of it always is to bring you back to that center. And bhakti yoga, karma yoga, jnana yoga, these are tributary streams. But ultimately, Kriya Yoga is the Raja Yoga, which takes you into the spine, without which you can't advance. When you practice bhakti, and you clap your hands and sing and dance and all those things, fine, it raises the heart. But what makes it fine is that you're raising the heart. And if you keep on doing it restlessly, the heart's feelings will go outward. If you understand the truth, you begin to feel that this love in the heart must be directed up here. Mm. Otherwise, the heart is the midpoint in the body, and it can go down as well as up. So you need to know how to direct it upwards. And all the different tributary streams into this central thing of the spine, they're good. You can keep on doing karma yoga till you're blue in the face, but it won't help you unless you understand that the purpose of it is to interiorize your own self. And jnana yoga, all of them. So the central teaching of yoga, and this is why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, O Arjuna, be thou a yogi. So Kriya Yoga has that. And when you can get that feeling of equanimity in the spine, you don't have to worry about, I must overcome my anger against that man who keeps throwing garbage over his fence into my yard. I must get rid of my anger against that person who's always spilling water on my feet when I pass him. I must get rid of my anger at this one and that one and the other. If you can go into your reactive process, you just don't get angry. I don't even know what it's like to get angry. I've forgotten. I don't know if I ever knew, but I certainly don't know now. So you find that with the such qualities as anger, it's very difficult if you think of it neti, 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 one thing at a time. But it becomes very easy if you center in the central attitude in the spine. And just every time you find yourself reacting to anything, think of this is where my reaction is, so become centered in yourself again. Very simple. The truths are very simple if you think of them. And so, three, they accept without prejudice whatever life gives them and live by the principle, what comes of itself, let it come. Now, I remember when SRF threw me out. They threw me out very brutally. They tried to destroy my faith in myself, my faith in my guru. They wanted to just get me out of their hair. And it was a sinful thing they did. And I actually, for a time, wondered, did Master even love me? I knew he did intellectually, but I felt that how could he allow this to happen to me? But I said to him, even if you don't love me, I love you, and you can't do anything about that. And I found that in time it was a great blessing, one of the greatest blessings of my life. And I wrote to Anandamoyi Ma at that time, and I told her what had happened, and she said, accept this as your guru's grace. Well, grace was the one word I could not accept. It didn't look like grace. But I have to say it was a great grace. It was one of the greatest blessings I've ever had, because it freed me to do the work that my guru had given me to do. I would have been under their thumb forever if I'd stayed there, and they could never have gotten rid of me except violently, because I was too loyal. So it was a great grace, and I have learned, painfully sometimes, but definitely, that if I can, by accepting everything that comes as it comes, I'm free. I don't have to worry about it. People get all upset, oh, why is this happening? Why did that happen? Why did you do that? If you can just take what comes of itself, let it come. You will find that a little bit of calmness, somebody can come to you all angry. If you listen to him, he may say, oh, this guy's listening to me, I don't have to be angry. And you can talk it out and find that basically you're really wanting the same thing. How many times have you seen that happen? So by letting everything come, if he wants to be angry, just let him be angry. Listen to him. Let life be what it is. Don't insist that it be what you want it to be. And you will see that in that case that everything has a good reason. There are reasons why people steal and murder even. Wrong reasons, okay, but it's their problem, not yours. I was very pleased, not with my action, but with my reaction. When I was in college, I was studying for a very boring exam. And I heard footsteps coming up. You've read this in the New Path. I think you've read it. Anyway, it's there. You'll read it. And these footsteps coming up over the grass, and I looked at my watch. It was about the time the library closed. So I thought it was probably one of my friends wanting to give me a fright. And then he'd come in the front door and we'd have a good laugh. So I went to the window to see who it was. These footsteps faded off. And so I thought, well, he'll come around now and we'll laugh about it. Nobody came. After about 20 minutes, somebody out of the same footsteps came tiptoeing across the lawn. And I thought, well, my friends aren't this this consistent about anything. And so I thought, maybe it's somebody here to shoot at me. And, you know, that was an idle thought. I didn't believe it for a moment. But I went to the window again, and these footsteps ran away. I said, well, the only way I'll know whether he's here to shoot me or not is to let him go ahead and shoot. And so I sat there, and the next time, about 20 minutes later, I heard these footsteps coming up, and foot placed on the ledge outside my window, and a hand grasping the grating outside. And I was just smiling down at my book, waiting for it to see what happened. All of a sudden, this loud shot rang out. Yeah. I was so surprised. And after a few moments, the ringing in my ears died down. I could hear the clock ticking again and this car racing off the campus. And I mean, I know I should be more careful of my life than that. But I was at least pleased that I didn't really care. I felt my body. There was no bullet hole. I looked at the wall. There was no bullet hole. I went to the window that was in the screen. There was no bullet or hole in the screen. I thought, well, what is all this craziness about? Then 2 days later, I remembered it had been Halloween. And in America, they have this holiday on Halloween where the children try to frighten people. And so it was some village youth who had thought, let me give a good scare to some college boy. And so he had come doing that. But I knew that I was not showing proper responsibility, but I was at least pleased that I hadn't. It didn't matter to me whether he shot me or not. Really, if one of you in this room right now were to shoot me, I'd say, go ahead. It wouldn't matter. And we must have that attitude in life that what comes of itself, let it come. That doesn't mean you shouldn't defend yourself. I've reached the point where I would not. I'll defend anybody else, but I won't defend myself. But I remember in school in England, there was this boy, Taylor his name was, and he said to me, you dirty foreigner. And I said, well, maybe you're a dirty Englishman. To me, it was a question of whether we'd bathed or not. And he leapt at my throat, just furious. And I was stronger than he, so I just held him down. And he was spitting up at me. And finally, he had to give up and admit that I'd beaten him. And so I let him get up and walk away. But I didn't want to hit him back. It was his problem. Why should I get involved? One time when I was new in America, as you know, I grew up in Europe, but I was 13 years old, and I weighed 107 pounds. And the boy in the room next to me was 230 pounds. He was 15 years old and very fat mostly, but big. And he could just sat on me like a and squashed me, you know. One morning I woke up and I saw his head peering around the window into my room with an air gun. I leapt behind the desk and this bullet went into the desk. And he just hated me. He felt that my English accent, which I had at that time, was an insult to the American glory or the flag or who knows what. And So I remember he sat next to me at the table one lunch, and he said, "Don't you know that you're supposed to drink your soup from the far side, peasant?" And he kept trying to insult me, and I just calmly ate and didn't pay any attention to him. Finally he said, "Boy, am I going to hit you." And I knew he meant it. And so when I got to my room, I pushed the door. I didn't have a lock on it, but I pushed it against the, pushed it shut and put the dresser in front of it. But it was no help with him. He just came and, breathing fire, he pushed the dresser aside and roared into my room and began beating me up. There was nothing I could do. I just sat there and took it calmly. Somebody later said to me, "Why didn't you shout for help?" I said, "I wasn't afraid." But he was saying, just almost out of breath with and whispering furiously, "I'm going to throw you out the window!" We were three stories above the ground, you know. Not an easy fate. But anyway, you know, the interesting thing was that he left me alone from then on. Mine was the moral victory, because I didn't flinch, I didn't beg for help, I didn't sob, I just let him do what he wanted to. And then he lost his power over me. Or he saw that he had no power over me. So if you accept what comes of itself, you'll find this world has no power over you. Even if it gives you very hard teachings, if you just accept it, it doesn't matter. It will leave you alone. And I have seen again and again that with that attitude, somehow everything always works out right. But I found more than I knew then. If you give it to God, God comes into the picture. And that's even more wonderful. So Master said that in the coming crises, and India is not in a good position, let's face it, economically the depression that is coming will be very hard worldwide. But it'll be easier in India, because if you fall from here to the floor, you don't hurt yourself. If you fall from three stories up, you can kill yourself. So Indians know how to deal with poverty in a way that people in America do not. But it's more than that. When you have depression, you have war. Here you've got Pakistan on one border, China on the other, China supporting Pakistan. You have a possibility of serious problems, I have to admit it. But here's a story to remember, and a very interesting one. It was just a few weeks ago that I read this, that when America dropped that bomb on Hiroshima, there was a spiritual group in the middle of Hiroshima who meditated. They were not even touched. They weren't affected by that bomb. Every devastation all around them. But Master said, those who love God will be protected. Does that mean none of them will be killed? I can't believe it, but maybe so. I would say, whatever the case, God will be with you and you will have peace. And that's the important thing. But I do think that the more we can get land outside the cities, the better. I don't think Delhi is in a very good position, I have to say. Mm. I thought Pune might be. Mm. It's the defense center of India. So let it be. God will be with you if you love him. And who knows how many deaths you have survived already. This is another thing. Just don't be afraid of death. When it comes, it's the easiest thing. You're just stepping out of one room into another. The pain may be in leaving your body because you may get cancer or something. Once you're out of your body, you feel relieved. It's a very nice feeling. So nobody after death, from psychics who have had these experiences, and I've read some books about them. There's a very interesting book which you'd all enjoy. It's by James von Prague. It's called Ghosts Among Us. And he had the ability to see people after they were dead. And all of them said it was very nice leaving their body. They didn't worry at all. So don't be afraid. Anyway, let's go on. People like that never seek to justify or defend themselves, but accept all judgment by others dispassionately as experiences given them by God for their higher gain and good. This is an important thing. The world is always judging you, always saying, why are you this way and why are you that way? You have a lot of peace of mind if you just don't care what other people think. And in order not to become arrogant and not caring, thank them. Because if they remind you that your ego is worth getting rid of, this is good, isn't it? I mean, if people tell you that you're brilliant, wonderful, beautiful, everything, you may think, oh, that's not pretty nice. But if people tell you you're ugly and stupid and ignorant and so on, instead of being insulted, say, thank you. I have found that when people tried to hurt me that way with words, and I just thanked them, it just, what can they do beyond that? You know, there is a story in France, they used to love to duel. My father, actually, in Romania, was once challenged to a duel. He simply ignored the man. He said, it's your problem, not mine. But there was one delightful story of an American in France who was challenged. He was challenged to a duel. And he, as being the person challenged, he had the right to accept to choose the weapons. So he chose apple pie at 10 paces. Hey, what is this, defending your honor? What honor, for God's sake? The people think of defending their family honor, defending their honor. It's a delusion. Don't worry about it. What people think of you, some people will like you, some people will not like you. This is the nature of this world. There's a beautiful thing that Saint Thérèse of Lisieux encountered once. Somebody said to her, you're looking so wonderful. What have you done? In the next room, somebody saw her, you're looking terrible. What's the matter? And she said, I realized what people say doesn't matter at all. So be even-minded in those things. They keep in their hearts primarily the company of God. Always live in the hermitage of your own little body. You can carry this temple with you wherever you go. You do carry it. So make it a temple. Always keep the company of God in your heart. Share your thoughts with him. Don't think he or she. Think you. And share your thoughts with him. I am walking in this body. You are walking through me. A dog barks. What are you trying to say to me through that dog? If you can walk quietly and just think that way, everything in the world around you, it's as if God was talking to you through the noises in the world around you. It becomes really a wonderful meditation. A car honks and you say, well, God, do you have something to say through that sound? You will be amazed that sometimes he does. I have noticed that if I accept what people tell me and listen to it respectfully, even if they're fools, sometimes God uses those people to tell me something I need to know. There was one woman who came to me with a suggestion for something or other, and she was a foolish kind of person, and my first thought was that, let me get her out of this as soon as I can. And I thought, no, maybe God wants to say something through her to me. And I listened, and he did. She made a very good suggestion. So wisdom can come to you from children, from silly people, from anybody. Be respectful of everyone, because everyone, even wise or foolish, it doesn't matter, they're all God's children. This is one of the wonderful things I found about my guru, his complete respect for everybody. You'd think somebody in his position would condescend. Well, you don't know this and that. No, he didn't talk like that. He had respect for everyone. We should have that kind of respect because God is in everyone. And another beautiful thing is that the more you feel bliss in yourself, the more you realize what everybody in the world is seeking is that same bliss. And they may seek it through power or fame or money or revenge, all sorts of negative reasons. But underneath, they're just making mistakes. There's no such thing as sin. When you understand they're all trying to find Satchidananda, and they just don't know how to find it yet. So the more you go into that bliss, so the more you find everybody, it becomes lovable. You see all of them, you see yourself in all of them. And I remember when I was a child at 9, I got a very severe case of colitis, and I was in delirium, and my father read to me from the novel Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. And Huckleberry Finn's father was a drunk and had tantrums and so on. And in my delirium, my head would toss back and forth at night afterwards, saying, "I don't want to be a drunkard, I don't want to be a drunkard." I understood many years later what I was saying. It was, I don't want to fall back into this delusion. It's so gripping, it can hold you. A little mistake and you can go wandering for many incarnations. It's just not worth it. And I was born with a terror of falling into it again. And I saw how easy it would be to fall. So easy to be anybody that you meet on the streets. All the things that he did that made him that way, you could do those things. We have the same capacity in us to rise and become like Krishna, or to fall and become like Ravana. We have that within us, because it's the same God in everybody. So we mustn't ever say, "Oh, I could never do that." You don't know. When Master talked about the mistakes that people make, he said, usually when you reach the human level, you don't go down again. But you can go down again if you live an animalistic life. There's even the story of Bharat. When he was king, he went into the forest. He became very attached to a deer. And when he died, he was worried about this poor deer. As a result, he was born again as a deer. And this deer wandered about the forest, ashrams and so on, and got his food there, and he knew he had spiritual inclinations, but he was a deer, an animal. And when he came back, well, he didn't want to get involved at all. He just wouldn't even speak to anybody. So anyway, you could fall. Master said you can fall, first of all, through attachment. I know there's a woman I know in Rome. She's 86, and she told me she doesn't want to die because she's worried about her poor blind dog. So I wrote her a letter and told her this story about Bharat, that your attachment to your dog is the way you have. You could become a dog. Do you want to? And usually what happens is that you incarnate as an animal and then you come back as a human being. You're already on this level. But if you keep on sinning, you can go down as far as a germ. And just think of the pain of this germ, not knowing why it is, but knowing it should be more than it is, and having to come all the way up. God, this is a frightening delusion. We must do everything we can to get out of it. But if you have love for God, He will protect you. I've said that before. I'll say it again in this context. They are indifferent to others' opinions of them. They work without personal motive to please God alone. Don't do anything with the thought that I want this, I want that. Always, I mean, most people do work with some of that thought. I want praise, I want to be liked, I want, of course, those are subtler thoughts. But the thought of money and power and those things, those are grosser thoughts. And you talked about wanting to have money. Well, the way to get rid of that desire is to earn money for other people. You should pay your rent. The money that we earn, you can get rid of that karma by sharing your wealth with other people. Otherwise, I remember one time outside Howrah Station here, outside Calcutta, and there was a band of gypsies there holding their hands out. And there was one girl there, I don't know, maybe 12 years old, maybe older, but I could see in her mind this thought, what am I doing here? She looked as if she had been maybe a Rani or a wealthy person who had lived selfishly, had been thrown into that low body, and this was her duty then to beg. But your life, whether you're rich or poor, depends on your karma. So always share what you have. But nishkam karma is the key that Krishna gave us for liberation. Whatever you do, do it for God. Do it without desire for the fruits. And you'll find that bit by bit you are overcoming your attachments and so on. I have worked very hard in this life, but I have never done it for me. I've done it to please my guru. I've done it to help other people to find God. I know when I read his autobiography and I was crossing America to meet him, I had two thoughts. One was to find God, and the other was, this is such a beautiful truth, I want the whole world to know about it. And so he saw that in me and made me his mouthpiece for the world, you might say. But this has been my desire, to help people to understand these truths. So if you have that kind of desire, that is a desireless desire. Some people say you shouldn't have any desire. That kind of desire is good. It helps to expand your ego, not to contract it. They are impersonal in the sense of wanting nothing for themselves, but never in the sense of being indifferent to the needs of others. Somebody I read in a book said that if you see somebody wallowing in a ditch, don't help him out, because that would be involving yourself in his karma. I say to that, that you're getting bad karma for not helping. When you see need, you must help that need. In one way or another, there are many ways of helping. If you give somebody money, he can go out and buy a little food. If you give him a job, he can be sustained all the time. If you give him happiness, he gets that which everybody's looking for. So there are grades of giving, but never, never be indifferent to the sufferings of others. They see all beings as striving toward the attainment of Satchitananda. And I said this, thus they feel a kinship with everyone and with all life. And as I said earlier, you know, I was in the city of Florence recently. Our distributors were there, and I went to meet the head of the firm, and I stayed in the hotel there. And I woke up at 3 o'clock with an inspiration, and I tried to find paper to write it on. There was no paper. Usually hotel rooms have notepaper. There was none. I didn't have any paper in my baggage. So finally I found this little glass with a paper doily under it, and I wrote this thought under that doily. And is it here? It would be worth sharing if it is. No. Anyway, I'll tell you that what I wrote was that the more bliss I feel, the more I find everybody I see around me and just utterly lovable. Because you know that's what everybody is looking for. And it's not that I feel that bliss constantly, but sometimes it's a mental affirmation, but when I feel it, just everybody, you can't help loving people. Because you know they're all looking for this, and they may look for it in wrong ways, and they may be criminals and so on, but poor things, they're the ones who suffer more than anybody else. So instead of hating them, you should love them. But there's no question of should love them. You can't help loving them when you feel this. They accept nothing as their own, but only as being on loan to them for the benefit of others. So never think that anything is yours. Master, one time, his father had bought him a very expensive motorcycle. And he used to drive Suyukteswar in it, his sidecar, and had a lot of fun with it. But one day, he saw a man looking longingly at this motorcycle. And he said, "Do you like it?" And the man said, "Oh, if only I had something like that." Master said, "Well, take it, it's yours." And he gave it away. He didn't belong to that motorcycle. Anything that you own, you belong to. So why be a slave to things? Just tell yourself, this is not mine. I'm enjoying it, but it belongs to God. And if you see somebody who wants it more than you do, give it away. It doesn't matter. You'll find a lot of freedom in that. They view pleasure and pain equally as opposite or dual expressions of eternal divine bliss. And I have found that it's very good to test your willpower in this sometimes. When I go to the dentist, I don't take Novocaine because I feel that a little pain never hurt anybody. It's good to inure yourself to pain. And while they're drilling and doing all sorts of things there, and I've had them do a lot to me, you know, because I had colitis, I wasn't allowed any dairy products. As a result, I had no calcium. And my teeth suffered badly. And in Bucharest, Romania, when I screamed too loudly, the poor dentist would just decide for his sake he'd better fill the tooth, even though there was still decay there. So naturally, when I got older, they were much worse. Anyway, I've just never accepted Novocaine. And I find that I can, while having them drilling and doing all their work, I can compose music or figure out some philosophical point for a book that I'm working on. And if you don't accept pleasure or pain and just be even-minded to both of them, it's a very good practice to expose yourself to both and say, it doesn't matter to me one way or the other. In the yoga tradition, there's one tradition of taking all your food for a meal and mixing it all together. Sweet, sour, pungent, everything. And it doesn't taste good. But just accept that this is food. I don't care about the taste of it. I don't recommend it. I'm just saying this is one method. I asked Master one time, "Sir, please help me to overcome a liking for good food." And he said, "Don't worry about those little things. When ecstasy comes, everything goes." So don't think I'm recommending this practice. But I am recommending that you do test your willpower sometimes. When it's cold, don't bundle up. When you find something unpleasant, don't cringe from it. Try to be even-minded in your acceptance and not let your heart go up and down in these feelings. You'll find that you become very calm with that. Nothing bothers you anymore. And people... Master said we have to learn how to stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. And we may come to such a time. I remember in Hollywood Church, he stopped the talk one time, and he shouted, "You don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming!" But a cataclysm means something planetary, usually. It doesn't mean just depression or war. And some people have said that maybe the Earth will be hit by some outer body. We're living in a cosmic environment. We're not just living in our little mud ball of a planet. And who knows what we have in the future? Several great saints have talked about such a time of testing. So if it comes to you, it may in your lifetime, may not in mine. But if you can be calm in yourself, you will find God in such times. This is a very important test. Don't let anything ruffle your feelings. They have meditated daily for years. Well, I trust this is true for everybody here. Because they are always happy in themselves, they are impervious to insults, outer suffering, failure, defeat, or disaster. They strive to live the ideal that Paramahansa Yogananda voiced when he said you should be able, as I said, to stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. And finally, they strive to love God unceasingly and ever more deeply in a spirit of utter openness to be guided by his will. Many people say, "God, I'll do anything." But this is really what you want, isn't it? Let God decide for you. He may suddenly strip you of everything, saying, "God, I accept it." You'll notice, however, this very interesting thing, that if you take it as coming from God, the test is passed very quickly. And if you kick and scream like a child having a tantrum, it will last a lot longer. So in fact, it's in your own interest in every way to say, because it'll come anyway. If you lose your job, if you lose your money, just say, "God, you show me." you'll find that many times an opportunity will come to you, but if you're all upset, you won't even see it. Whereas if you're open to anything, then the least little thing that comes, you can hear the voice of God. This is the direction to go. When he slams every door in your face, just wait, the door will open. He will not abandon you. This I can promise you, because you are his devotees, and he loves you.